New Zealanders want and deserve a transparent and comprehensive inquiry into the COVID-19 response, not another whitewash. That's why RCR is bringing you a special segment aimed at examining the terms of reference, as well as what the country's best and brightest minds believe should be put on the table and why. The inquiry sessions will endeavour to unpack everything we already know and all the things we still don't know about how the COVID response was handled and what needs to be included in any new inquiry so that New Zealanders can get answers, justice and a future free from government overreach. Welcome to the inquiry sessions. My name is Alastair Harding and welcome to another edition of the Inquiry Sessions here on Reality Check Radio. It's been some time since we did an interview for this series, but I get the feeling because of stories like the one you're about to hear today, that we're going to be doing this series for years to come. Because the COVID era brought out the best and the worst in our country, and today I have for you a story that encapsulates both of those two things. It's a story about some of the worst behaviour our country has ever seen, because it's a tale of the medical council scouring the country, searching through prescription records and QR code tracing data for any sign of disloyalty to the national vaccination program of the COVID era. And despite all the protections in law for our right to privacy, to refuse medical treatment, and for informed consent, those Stasi-styled medical council operatives have succeeded in prosecuting and destroying the careers of any and every doctor who did not comply. But it's also the story of the best our country has to offer, because it's a story about a pair of individuals who dared to stand up against what they perceived to be a misuse of power, and did so despite knowing it would come at a massive personal cost. And whether you agree with what they did or not, the fact is, when your issue comes knocking, you too will look for the strength that these two have displayed. And perhaps then, you'll search your memory banks for this story. It's also a special story for us here on Reality Check Radio because it's the story of one of our own, Marie Buskey, and her husband, Phil McDonald, who as a doctor in the Hawke's Bay was hunted down by the medical council for refusing to be vaccinated and then daring to try and keep his business alive by practicing under a new health system. The upshot, Phil has now been prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law, so that now he stands as an example to doctors all over the country. Do as the medical council says, or we will ruin you, no matter how unethical the behaviour you're being asked to do is. Until now, Phil and Marie have had to stay silent, as Phil's case went the distance in our court system. But now it's over, and Phil has been found guilty and convicted and fined on 19 charges. And because of that, the name suppression is now lifted, and Phil and Marie are here to tell their story. Okay, so welcome Phil McDonald and Marie Buskey to the latest edition of the Inquiry Sessions here on Reality Check Radio. Thanks for being here.
Yeah, you're welcome, Alicia.
Thanks for inviting me.
Okay, so I want to start first with the position you're in. You were a doctor, an ophthalmologist, but not anymore due to the whole COVID saga that we're talking about today. What was it that you were charged with and found guilty of? And I noticed that they charged you with a lot of things. So was there anything that they didn't actually find you guilty of?
Well, just at the beginning, I'll say that I'm speaking as a private individual. So I'm not a registered medical practitioner anymore. And although I'm a member of the New Zealand Doctors Speaking Out for Science, this isn't officially a statement from them. So these words are my own. I'm a member of the World Health Council. And again, not their words, but mine. And I'm not a registered medical practitioner. So if there's anything medical coming up, they'll need to see their registered medical practitioner. I'm just speaking as a private individual. Yeah, I was found guilty of practicing without a license. The crux of the court case was I was attempting to practice under the Whakamininga Health Council. So it was set up by a couple of individuals who were also members of New Zealand Doctors Speaking Out for Science. And that health council was set up using tikanga as its core principle. And it was set up as an alternative regulatory body from the New Zealand Medical Council, as there were a number of us that were unhappy with the New Zealand Medical Council and how it had behaved during the COVID pandemic.
So you're deregistered from the health system and you'd registered with this tikanga group to try and keep working.
There was an overlap. Well, there was an overlap briefly where I made sure that I was, so I was always registered with a regulatory body at any one time. But yes, there was a time when I was registered with the New Zealand Medical Council, then I registered with the Whakamalinga Health Council, and then I deregistered from the New Zealand Medical Council. So there was a period where I was actually registered with two. And then basically the Whakamalinga Health Council, their legitimacy was tested in the High Court. And I was advised to try and delay my case while that case churned through the High Court. And sadly, it wasn't found in Whakamalinga Health Council's favour. I think if it had have been, and they'd been legitimised in that court, my case would have been dropped, but it wasn't, and then my course proceeded. And yes, I was subsequently found guilty of practising without a medical licence.
And there were 19 charges.
Basically, there was, they had harvested a number of my patients and had got them to write various affidavits indicating that I had acted as a doctor when I wasn't officially registered as one.
Okay, so let's go back right to the very beginning. Can you tell me about your business? What was it and what part did both of you play in it? Because I understand, Marie, you were part of the business as well.
I was an ophthalmologist working in the Hawke's Bay region for about 20 years as a consultant ophthalmologist. For 13 years, I worked at the Hawke's Bay District Health Board and operated at Royston Hospital. In subsequent years, I had designed and built, with the help of my lovely wife, a private surgical centre, a private day-to-day hospital in Napier. I had looked at the region and thought that there was a big gap in the services that Napier had. So I drew up my plans, and it was a huge undertaking. It took about 10 years. And I designed it specifically with ophthalmology in mind because I'm an ophthalmologist, but I'd also made it multi-purpose. So it was a facility that could provide for other surgical specialties as well. And indeed, that's what's happening. It's still in use, but it's, interestingly, everything but not ophthalmology.
And what was your part in it, Marie?
I sort of did a lot of the zoom out stuff. So a lot of the strategy of where the business sat, the financial elements, and it was actually divided into two separate businesses. So we had Napier Eye Ophthalmology and Bay Elective Surgical Theatre. So I worked with our key nurse and anaesthetist. And so she and I worked together in terms of bringing in external business outside of ophthalmology into the practice. So that included things like a private oral surgeon, and we also had a contract with the Hawke's Bay DHB, which took 2 years to get across the line for paediatric dental and just sort of things like that. And just, you know, basically keeping the runway clear so Phil could sort of do what he needed to do from an ophthalmic perspective.
And Phil, throughout your trial, you were given name suppression so the media couldn't identify you. But once it was all over and the name suppression was lifted, the photo they used for you in the New Zealand Herald article about your case was the one from your company website. And you're sitting there in your surgery with a big smile on your face. No doubt it was taken in the days before COVID turned everything upside down. And you look like a very happy man.
Oh, I certainly was. It was fun to design the building. I'd built it, you know, hundreds of times in my mind and picked all the equipment right down to where the wall plugs went and where the orientation of all the stuff out of the ceiling. Was able to handpick the staff as well as the gear, and it all just ran beautifully. And we did a lot of homework. And I looked at a lot of facilities around the country. I went to a course over in America with was an architect who ran the course who had built like 600 of them across the States. And he was just amazing. And we had a really good staff, and it did meet a need in Napier. The population's older, and older people get more ophthalmic problems.
So this was your life. And you've just told us how much thought and effort had gone into it. So this was no easy decision. But let's go back to that time when COVID arrived. We were all locked down. Vaccines were coming. And then we were told that no one would be forced to take them. But then when they did arrive, most people were mandated them, chiefly the medical sector. And here you were, the two of you running a medical center. There's a lot on the line here. What made you make the decision to not get injected?
Yes, as a personal philosophy, I never wanted to take anything experimental. I had a former colleague, I remember, once he had a holiday job as a student, basically as a human lab rat, and spent 3 months taking experimental drugs. And I just thought, this is nuts. You're a human fuse. You know, it's your health here. And I think often you have to look back to see forward. One of the things that I looked at was just my medical school training. We were trained that any new drug, you know, had to go through multiple rounds of intensive and structured testing. And they were divided into phases, phase one, phase two, phase three, phase four. And I remember listening to Donald Trump on the telly talking about his Operation Warp Speed, and they're going to, you know, trot it out in record time. And it's like, I don't care how many PhDs you've got. I don't care how many labs you've got or how many computers you've got or centrifuges or whatever. You can't go through all of those tests adequately in that time. You're going to skip essential points. It cannot be done adequately. So I had concerns about that. And I remember reading in the Herald how this was a novel and completely new mechanism. And they had these little diagrams with the mRNA and the RNA and the DNA and where it was going and basically how these novel therapeutics were going to work. And I was like, this is genetic engineering rather than this is a vaccine. Vaccines, is, from a sort of a simple surgical perspective, is a bit of dead bug or weakened bug. And that's tried and true technology. It's been around for, you know, 100 years. I'm very comfortable with that. And I've had many vaccines, and my children have had vaccines, and my wife's had vaccines. So that wasn't an issue for me. But when I looked at this and they're chucking around genetic material, I was like, well this is actually genetic engineering. And I have quite a jaundiced view of it, I'll be honest. Ophthalmology is an interesting specialty because although we deal with a small organ, it's actually a surprisingly broad specialty in that we deal with both medical and surgical sides of the equation. And I looked at my therapeutic armamentarium, and we had lots of drugs, and I had lots of lasers and high-tech surgery and machines that go big. We didn't have any genetic engineering. And in fact, I wasn't aware of any widespread clinical adoption of genetic engineering that actually worked. And when I cast my mind back, the promise was that you could have therapeutics that could, you know, grow a new heart or grow skin or replace a limb or strengthen a diseased heart. I mean, there was the movie Jurassic Park stemmed out of that, where they, you know, they grew dinosaurs from remnants of DNA and fossilized amber. But you know what? Jurassic Park never eventuated. And I would argue that we had 40 years of promise and 40 years of failure. And really the hill that I think a lot of genetic engineering died on was cancer. And it's actually a much harder task to master than we had first thought. There's actually a whole lot more to the genetic code than we fully grasp. There's vast complexities with the immune system. It's mind-boggling. You start delving into it, it's just a sea of information that you could drown in. And it's like, well, you know, I think we're actually like a monkey with a stick. And yet you're thinking that you're a violinist in a symphony, and we're just not. We need to be a little bit more humble here. And so I just did more and more research into it. And the first thing that fell apart was interestingly to me, was the virus. And that was sort of presented as a novel virus and unprecedented, you know, risks. And so, well, you know, if you look at the common cold, you've got respiratory syncytial virus, adenovirus, influenza virus, and bada bing, bada bang, at the end, coronavirus. And if you add those five together, you've got 80% of the common causes of viral upper respiratory tract infection. It's actually been around a while.
So for a lot of us, you know, those early days of the pandemic was all about learning how to read medical literature and studies and all of that stuff. You'd been reading this your whole working life, your whole career. This didn't make sense to you.
Well, a whole lot of things didn't make sense to me. Yes, that was one. I stumbled on an interesting article from a journal called Virology, and that was put out by the Wuhan Institute of Virology. And it wasn't called gain of function, but it basically was gain of function. It was a very technical article, and I had to read it a number of times and look up a whole lot of words. It was obviously written for experts in that area, and I certainly wasn't that. And once I got the gist of it, I found it profoundly unsettling. They were basically making new bugs, making a Frankenvirus, as it were, and they described how they chopped out a middle section of the virus's genetic code and spliced in another sequence. And what that did was it facilitated viron entry into human cells. Basically, it made Frankenvirus suddenly infect humans. And they didn't actually mention the phrase, I think, in the article, but later it became commonplace, gain of function. And I found that profoundly unsettling. I was like, why would people make new bugs to infect people? Why would we create diseases that can only cause human misery and death? We've gone down a very dark path there. And then I was like, well, this is a really key article. You know, this is in the scientific literature and it has profound implications. And so I actually emailed it in. I was a fan at that time of The Breakfast Show with Duncan Garner. And I thought, gee whiz, this is, you know, worthy material.
And they did a whole show on it, no doubt, after you'd sent it in?
Yeah, it was kind of like tossing a pebble down a well, really. It was, I didn't get hit with a lot of splashback on that one. And I found that very unsettling as well. I think, you know, that one of the things with COVID-19 was it wasn't that dangerous. There wasn't this big mountain of excess deaths. You know, time and again, we would go under lockdown, and I think it was Sean Hendy, the professor from Auckland, of the stochastic model, and he was predicting thousands of deaths, and we were all scared witless, and we'd all locked down, and nothing much would happen, and then it would happen again, and it's like, gee whiz, I don't think I'd get this guy to count my toes.
Okay, but you guys are working in the medical industry. You've got friends who are working in the hospital, no doubt, and in the pharmacies and all of that. You must have seen the chaos that the media were constantly talking about. You must have seen the hospitals overflowing and the understaffed, the overworked and understaffed doctors and nurses and all of that. You would have been surrounded by this, surely.
Oh, my God. No, we didn't. I mean, what we were drowning in was chaos.
And fear.
And fear, yeah. There was saturation marketing, wall to wall marketing, you know, with Jacinda and Bloomfield on the telly every day. And everyone's scared witless, and there was the traffic light system and these colours, and in the first year of it, it was very difficult to actually know what to do. And there was actually the New Zealand Ophthalmology Society, and I was a member of that, and they organised a Zoom meeting with a couple of bureaucrats from the Ministry of Health, just to try and clarify whether we, you know, what we actually do with all these colours and these weird diagrams. And, you know, it was all incredibly complicated. You just actually wanted to know what to actually do. I mean, it was all COVID theatre, but I was keen to dot the I's, cross the T's, and in every way try and conform with the standards as they were trotting out, although I quietly didn't actually agree with many of them. I mean, things like having to wear masks. I mean, you can just look up with Google. You can look up the size of the pores in a mask or an N95 mask, and it's in the micron size. So as if you look up viruses and virons and stuff, it's like nanometers. You know, it's like you're trying to catch a mosquito with a hula hoop. You know, it's not going to work. It was never going to work.
I mean, the thing for both of us is we had back channels in government, and one of those people said to me at that time, they are literally making this up as they go along. They had no idea what they were doing, the government. And we know from the lockdown and the testing that Seymour did, that they also locked us down unlawfully. They had no right to lock us down in those early stages. So we had all of those bits of information and the fear that was going around, and we just didn't get caught up in the hypnosis. Like, we've the whole time we were sitting there going, why are people getting so scared about this? This is crazy. And I know for us, the cruise ship was quite a big one too, because when the cruise ship happened, happened, it was, that gave us a pretty clear indication. It was kind of like, all right, well, it's a bad flu, but it's not, you know, let's stop the world on it type flu.
No.
But that didn't seem to matter to the powers that be. And Jacinda was up there every day at 1 o'clock. And it was kind of like, I mean, you kept saying to me all the time, this is invasion of the body snatchers. This is invasion of the body snatchers.
Yeah, I actually made the family watch it. Absolute classic. Where all these people that were normal functioning people suddenly get infected by this alien, I don't know what it was, dare I say, virus. And then they're offline. They look the same, but as soon as their mouths open, they're quite different. And that was kind of how I felt here, living in New Zealand for sure.
What about your colleagues in the medical industry? I mean, are you guys the only ones seeing this? Or were others talking about it as well and just going, okay, we've just got to get on with it?
Well, yeah, I mean, it was a dawning sort of a realization, you know, the virus wasn't as bad as was portrayed. So there was a whole range of opinions within the medical profession. And I'd like to point out there always are, and there should be. And medical science is always trotting forward. So there's a range of opinions as data changes and comes to hand. I mean, when I was training to be an ophthalmologist, I worked in New Zealand under a little over 30 eye surgeons and watched them doing cataract surgery. And it's arguably the most common operation that most surgically orientated ophthalmologists do. I never saw it done exactly the same way. There was always little wrinkles and this, that, and the other. And you could always learn something from how it was done. Even if it was, gee, I don't think I like to do it that way. You could still learn something. And so when that guidance statement came out, I was had a moment of profound disquiet. Suddenly, the medical council had morphed from what had previously been just a straightforward regulatory body with three primary functions. They would assess your qualifications. They would also weed out the mad, the bad, and the sad, basically. So doctors with, you know, mental health issues or doctors that had failed to live up to the moral standards that the profession required. And then they also, their third primary function was that they were a disputes resolution body. Inevitably, you know, there will be things that happen and patients feel that they weren't treated right or there were complications, and it's important that they have somewhere to go to. And I had no problem with the medical council doing that, but suddenly it went from that to you must support this COVID health response, you should take the vaccine, and you should promote all the COVID health measures. And there was quite a dictatorial statement. And suddenly I thought, well, this is sort of, it made me think of those terrible North Korean videos where you look at all the people sitting in the audience and they're all clapping in unison after the leader speaks, and no one's allowed to think independently and nobody's allowed to individualize their choices. And what I loved as a doctor, quite honestly, was observing the Hippocratic Oath and individualizing those choices, fine-tuning it to an individual. You just never knew what would walk in the door. You might have the same operation, you might have a patient with the same condition as the one that walked out, and you'd offer them different advice because that was a different situation. They were a person. You could individualize it. And I really enjoyed the Hippocratic Oath from the perspective that you were putting what was best for the patient first, not your allegiance to the medical council or your allegiance to a political party or a big farm or anyone else. It was the patient. And I loved that. And I felt that medicine, once I read that, had lost something. Well, suddenly we had lost our wriggle room to observe the Hippocratic Oath, to form our own medical opinion about medical matters. And when it trotted out, I found it incredibly deceitful because we got that. And it wasn't just us, it was actually the dental council as well. I think they trotted it out quite quick.
Everybody
got this dreadful statement. And then a week later, Jacinda Ardern was on with her daily party political broadcast on all things COVID. And she said, with something to the effect of, for all you vaccine-hesitant people, I'd like you to see the health professional who knows you the best. I'd like you to see your GP and discuss the issues. And I thought, wow, this is such a stitch-up job because you've just muzzled the medical profession. We can't speak out about it. We've been threatened that we'll be censured if we do. We might lose our license. We have to endorse this. All these people are going to go to the doctor and they're going to think that they're getting, you know, Hippocratic Oath, doctor, what the doctor actually thinks. And no, what they're getting is what the party thinks. What we're getting is the North Korean view.
In terms of our colleagues too, Alistair, like, you know, we, you know, talked to a number of people across a lot of disciplines, and they fell into four distinct groups. They were the people like us who were just like, what on earth is going on here? Why can't anybody else see this as clearly as we're seeing it? And we're making the, you know, forming the decision, no, we're definitely not going to do this. Then there were the group that saw it, but we're in a position, whether it be financial, social, or otherwise, that they felt that they couldn't not conform to a mandate. So they had that real frustration that they felt coerced, they were forced to do something that they ultimately, if left to their own devices, they wouldn't have done, but they needed to do it. Then the third group were ones who were, they had a trust. And I had one colleague and friend, particularly another senior surgeon, said to us, you know, oh, but this has come down from the Ministry of Health. They won't deliberately be putting us in harm. I don't have time to read everything like you have. I trust that what they're telling us is good advice. So they just felt that, okay, they won't be put crook by the ministry or by Ashley or whoever. And then the fourth group were the full-on COVIDians, absolutely that North Korean style clapping, we are the team of 5 million, and if you're not on the boat, if you're not on the team, if you're not there, you're the enemy. And those were the sort of four groups that we had. And the advice that was given and what was laid out by the government is that if you're in the ministry, and is that you even got to a point that you couldn't talk to each other about this, and then you started worrying about horizontal policing, that if I say something or gather this opinion, is someone going to dob me in because of this guidance statement that had come down? You know, this is how you must think. And it was awful.
I'll give you another, if I may interject, episode of disquiet. Just before the first lockdown, I stumbled across some work by a French infectious diseases expert, and he was touted as the top infectious diseases expert in the world. And he had done, I think it was like a 80-case series with hydroxychloroquine, treating it for COVID. And it wasn't just mild COVID. These were advanced cases in the hospital, sick as dogs, and the results were absolutely miraculous. And so I was firing off prescriptions. And this is when I was, you know, registered with the medical council, and when doctors were allowed to prescribe for off-license uses of medications. And things have changed profoundly in this country. And I fired one off to the anaesthetist that I was working with and some friends around here. I got some for my family and stored some up for some. And hydroxychloroquine was a drug that I was really quite familiar with because it's a remarkably benign drug and been around for 60 years. But the point of the story was I also sent a prescription up to my mum. And in the time between me firing the prescriptions and filling them in Hawke's Bay and my mum getting it, it was all withdrawn from the shelves, the pharmacy shelves. And my mum was like, I can't fill that prescription, Phil. Can't get it. And I'm like, what? And suddenly this alternative treatment had been removed. And I found that profoundly unsettling because, A, it's benign. B, there's a chance that it works. There's at least one study showing quite good evidence of it. Hey, shot to nothing. I mean, why not? It's anything but experimental in terms of its safety profile. It's been around 60 years.
And it was more than that, too. It wasn't just hydroxychloroquine. It was also vitamin D. It was melatonin. Our son was prescribed melatonin. We went to get his melatonin prescription, and they said, sorry, it's been removed from the shelf. We can't get it. We can't dispense it.
I said, I'll try playing, you know, steel man argument here. Maybe they were going on at the time about international supply lines, and you know, maybe we're going to be cut off from suppliers of pharmaceuticals. So maybe they've got some sort of central repository where they're hoarding all the hydroxychloroquine, and you know, if we really do get these big waves of thousands of people dying, that it's important that it's that the supply of it's rationalized, and rather than just GPs and whatnot doling it out, this, that, and the other. And I waited for it to get doled out, and I waited and I waited, and it never did. And then later on, the similar thing happened with ivermectin, which turns out was even more effective at getting pumping in the old zinc into the cells and helping with the fight against the infection. And, you know, it was later branded as horse paste and this, that, and the other. It's like, not true. It's in human form. It's in pills. It was easily prescribed, well-tolerated. And I think that one's been around for like 40 years.
Yeah, and that's one of the biggest scandals of the whole saga. I mean, that ivermectin was denied to people, even though it had been used for decades. But moving on, so far we've established you're uneasy about the response, you're uneasy about the vaccines, and you decide to deregister as a doctor. Is that right?
That's half right. You're right. I didn't want to take the vaccine, but also I didn't want to advise my patients to take it either. So I had this thing called the Hippocratic Oath. and the precautionary principle. And, you know, my patients did ask me, not all of them, not in large numbers, but they did ask. And I couldn't look them in the eye and, from my perspective, lie for Jacinda Ardern. I just couldn't do it. So there were two reasons. You're right. I didn't want to take an untested medication, but I didn't want to foster it off of my patients either.
So you chose to deregister voluntarily. Why at that point, see, this is the part which I don't quite understand. Why at that point did you not just go, you know what, we'll close the doors and we'll wait this out? But instead, you chose to go down this tikanga route. Can you talk me through that?
There were many reasons I felt that we should go down that route. I had lost faith with the medical council. I had encountered this Whakamininga Health Council, and I'd read its founding articles, and it harked back to the original principles which resonated for me why I signed up as a doctor, where the beating heart of it was the Hippocratic Oath. Again, so important, and that it didn't require me to break that oath to my patients. When I first read it, I felt like crying. It's like, this is the counsel that I can get behind. All the ideals that I'd been taught at medical school, it espoused. And so that was a mechanism by which I could continue to practice medicine like I always had. And they did a very deep dive into tikanga and the law. And it looked like they'd presented it very cast iron, very well thought out. They went to Whakamininga up in Northland, and it got endorsed, I understand, by every tribe in the country. And I thought we had a very ironclad, a very valid health body to go into, that one that I was very proud to sign up with. I looked offshore at Australia. I think they've got 14 medical boards. America, I think, has got 72. And I thought, well, New Zealand, you know, we could have a second health council. There's room for that here. And another thing that I had gradual growing disquiet with the New Zealand Medical Council, I'm old enough to remember when, you know, it was sort of an autonomous, self-guiding body where it was democratically elected doctors. You know, it was a group of doctors for doctors, self-governing body. And then I think it was in the Helen Clark years, they started having political appointees, and there were lay people, and then lawyers weren't on it. And suddenly I think we've got like three lawyers on there, one of them that's brokered the deal and the contract for Pfizer. And I just thought there's huge conflicts of interest, and it had lost its way.
And there were also practical reasons, Alistair, as well. So we had patients booked through to about, because they extended the date for the mandate, and we had essentially only about a week's worth of work after that mandate date. But a lot of that was seeing patients post-operatively and actually having a duty of continuity of care to those patients. So we thought, well, we will just continue to see those patients in that time to make sure that everything was all rounded off and done completely. And then we generally take a long sort of summer Christmas break. And we thought, well, let's take the Christmas break, think about what we're going to do, and do exactly that. Do we close up shop and wait it out? The problem with that is that, and this was the key, I think the key decision that happened at that time, was at that point they'd mandated the two jabs, then they turned around and they mandated the booster. And the difficulty there was, as we suddenly thought, well, there is going to be no end to this. They're just going to keep mandating. How long are they going to keep mandating us for? Yeah. This is going to be more than just a few weeks or a few months. This could be years that these mandates continue. We had thousands of patients on our books, the only ophthalmologist in Napier. There were two other private ophthalmologists in Hastings, but who did not have a lot of space. So, and not everybody could get in or get across to there. So you had issues with accessing care. You had we had staff that, you know, we spoke to them and sort of said, these are what we're thinking about. We explained to them what we're doing with tikanga, gave them the option, did they want to stay and did they want to go. One of our administrative staff, she decided, our receptionist and admin manager said, no, I don't feel comfortable saying. But the other three key staff were like, yep, no, we will stay with you. They all chose to be vaccinated. So they were all vaccinated. They made that decision themselves. And so they were happy to continue to work. And you can't just, particularly the medical staff, You can't just pluck these out off the shelf. So if we were to close and if we were to ride it out for however long it is, we couldn't just turn the lights back on again and go back into business, because we would have had to have let all of those staff go. You can't just turn around and pick them up. You know, there are all of these sorts of considerations. And the tikanga argument is something in law that has been pushed very, very heavily as a relevant point of law. And we saw that, and we saw the government were moving at that. And you just need to see what they're now doing currently at Auckland University around making it mandatory to learn that as an element of law. And so when you have a medical council that is being set up under tikanga, and they were doing it in such a way, it wasn't a fly-by-night. They had gone out and done extensive research, had done meeting hui, kōti, had met with iwi leaders. They had done their due diligence on this.
Okay, what about, I'm trying to think back to that time, and I would expect at this point that this would have been a conversation that people were having, so perhaps the DHB, who would have been sending you a lot of the patients, did they offer support at this point for people that didn't want to go down this road?
It was amazing. It was a little bit like we were Anne Frank, you know. We had gone under the Whakamaringa, we'd made that very public, and we'd put that in the posters in the consult rooms, posters in the waiting room, and all our referrers knew. But we were just trying to continue practicing as we always had. It fascinates me. We were called up by Southern Cross, and they demanded to know my vaccine status, which I felt was my private personal information. But they have a preferred provider list for all of the people that sign up onto that. We had the same thing from the District Health Board, and I hadn't worked at the DHB for like 7 years, and they were like, and they had a contract with us for the paediatric dental. I think it was on Fridays, and so I didn't even work. I didn't even set foot in the building Fridays, and they were demanding to know my vaccine status. And it's like, well, I'm not in the building. It doesn't impact, and I'm not working for you guys anymore. And they were like, not good enough. Pulled the contract. So I wouldn't describe it as supportive. No.
They didn't try and help people figure out how they could still provide the service, because I would have expected that, you know, what you guys were providing there, you take that away, you're leaving a massive hole for the community there.
They didn't care. Yeah.
But that is a very good point, and I don't want to wax lyrical about the recent court case, but I will make one point that the lawyer for the prosecution made, which I take issue with. And he said, if there was just one ophthalmologist in the country, that's all that needs. You can't argue that you were an essential service. And that's just not my clinical experience. There's a number of medical conditions that you have to monitor that are time sensitive, like glaucoma and diabetic retinopathy. And you've just got to get these people rolling through. And if you don't, bad things happen, and sometimes those bad things are irreparable. So there is a time-dependent thing, and there is a work rate, you know, for every ophthalmologist. And so that idea that one ophthalmologist could cover the country and everything would be fine was a nonsense. And unfortunately, I have heard of a number of unfortunate things that have happened to my patients ensuing because it's very short-staffed, and I think that's happening across the country.
Okay, so they started, you had Southern Cross calling you up, asking you had the DHB calling you up and asking you whether you were vaccinated. It sounds to me like it's starting to almost be like a witch hunt. They're trying to root out all the unvaccinated doctors in the country. Is that how it felt?
Very much, yeah. So. Witch hunt and witch trial, yep, you bet. Yep, that's exactly how it felt.
And we were also seeing what was happening to Alison Goodwin and Peter Kennedy and Matt Shelton and Manny Garcia. You know, they and also to Elena Bishop, who's a really good friend, and she, we saw what happened to Elena firsthand, and she, you know, she worked as a pathologist.
At the local DHB.
At the local DHB, and what they did to her was appalling.
I mean, primarily she had a little video that she posted on some sort of social media platform, and basically she just made the point that these aren't you know, classical vaccines at all. And from that, she lost her job and she left the country went to America, and she was registered over there as well, had worked over there. She's got a consultant job over there. I understand she told me that the medical council tried very hard contacting her regulatory bodies over there to get her sacked, and they ignored her. Similar thing happened to another ophthalmologist who was almost in an identical position to me. He was an ophthalmologist in Otago, and he was in the process of building his own day-to-day hospital and got called out, and a whole lot of unfortunate articles were written about him, and he just went offshore. He went back to the UK and got a job practicing there, and he reported to me that the New Zealand Medical Council tried very hard to, again, get him sacked over there.
So these guys aren't actually just going to the doctors and saying, hey, get vaccinated or take a seat on the bench for a little while. They're going out of their way to destroy the rest of their careers.
Yes. It was mind-boggling. And these people, you know, they were fleeing the country, and it was not without personal cost. Elena Bishop, she went with one of her daughters, and she left her husband and her other children behind. And similarly, Deepak Gupta, I understand, he left his family behind. He had a young family. And I thought about it because I'd worked in the UK. I could have done what he had done. And I took a deep breath and decided to stay in this country and try and continue medical practice as I had always done. And I thought we had a really good chance of doing it. As it turned out, I was wrong.
I want to ask one more question about how they went around rooting doctors out. And Marie, you told me this when we spoke about this before this interview, that one of the ways they came looking for you was they went through the data from the QR codes that everyone was supposed to put on the clinic, and it was supposed to be used for contact tracing purposes. Surely this was illegal, using that to cold call patients who may or may not know something about this very bad doctor.
Yeah, so the law we've discovered when it comes to both the Ministry of Health's enforcement officer, and she was, her title was Senior Enforcement Officer, and also the New Zealand Medical Council with other people that we know, is that it's very, very elastic. So in our case, Phil applied for voluntary deregistration in December, and it didn't actually become ratified until the end of January. So he still had Medical Council registration until the end of January. There were two things they did. One was the QR codes. We had a patient come to us who happened to be one of our son's teachers, and he came to us and he said, look, I got this phone call from the Ministry of Health, and she wanted to know whether or not I'd seen you. And he was aware that we were working under an alternative health council, so he knew the situation. And he said she made these accusations about you not being vaccinated. I don't care. I want to get my eyes seen. So I asked her, though, how did you know that I'd been there? And she said, oh, we note that you had scanned in to the practice when you'd arrived, because we were following all the rules. We had the QR codes up, we were following all the protocols. The only thing that was different about running the practice was that Phil was not registered with the medical council, but with this alternative council, but everything else was the same. And he was appalled by that, absolutely appalled. And he said, look, I just think you should know, because they're phoning around. And we had other patients who then told us, they're ringing us, and we were
thinking, and referrers,
referrers were telling us. And then I also, next minute, I get a phone call from the senior enforcement officer from the ministry, and I asked her, I said, how did you happen to get my details? Now, Phil and I have different surnames. She hadn't clocked that we were married. And she said, oh, well, I got it from a prescription record of a prescription that Dr. McDonald happened to have written for you. And I was wanting to know, did you see him in consult at that time? Were you aware he is not vaccinated? So she's telling me this in a phone call, not realizing who I was. I was blown away. I was like, firstly, you're telling me about this doctor's vaccination status, which is his private medical vaccination status.
You would have thought.
How did you know that he wasn't vaccinated without looking that up against
the registry?
The registry.
Hold on, this can't be legal. I mean, we're talking about somebody from the medical council here. We're not talking about someone from the police, which who has legal powers and so on. We're talking about someone from the medical council going through QR codes and prescriptions.
Not the medical council, the New Zealand Ministry of Health.
But that's still not a legal body, surely.
No, well, that was tested in court, the fact that Phil's vaccination status was looked up by the senior enforcement officer from the Ministry of Health.
She got an anonymous tip.
And that was apparently all it took, was an anonymous tip.
Didn't bat an eye on that one.
To justify looking at
it. Which, little chill up my spine. If they can do that to me, you know what? They can do it to you too.
And so then charges are laid. Is that how it goes from there?
Yep.
What were the charges?
Seeing patients
without a license.
Yeah, but essentially two groups. One is consulting with patients without being a medical practitioner. A second of doing what they call unlawful acts, which is like surgery, basically, without a medical license. And I think there was one, I think because you called yourself a doctor or on our website, Phil was still referring to himself as an ophthalmologist whilst not being registered. And it was a small handful of patients. So like one patient may have had a couple of visits and a procedure, and that may have accounted for three or four charges, for example. So I think it was about six or seven patients all told.
And 17 charges.
19,
yeah, something like that.
Mm. And did those patients, were they in court? Were they reading victim impact statements and all of that?
One.
And they genuinely felt like they'd been wronged?
Well, you'll have to ask them that. But what I can say is when I got the list of patients, I was, had a computerized system, and so I looked it all up, and every single one of them, from my perspective, had excellent outcomes. Any of them that had received surgery, the surgery was successful, and any that received, you know, a diagnosis of medical treatment, they were either stable or cured. And I hadn't recorded any problems from an interpersonal perspective, or that they should go be seen elsewhere, or any issues with staff or anything. So, and I kind of knew that that would be the case because I'd had, you know, two or three years of very, very successful treatment. I'd really hit my straps, and but I really did want to check that they had the very best possible service and make sure, you know, coming up to this court case, heaven help me if I'd actually had an actual medical complication. I mean, boy, would have I got the book thrown at me. But no, it was more their mental health had been compromised by the thought that I was unvaccinated and had trouble sleeping, I think was one of them.
Yeah, the biggest gripe with, because many of them made statements, the biggest gripe that most of them had was that Phil either wasn't wearing a mask or wasn't wearing a mask correctly in their view, even though Phil had a mask exemption, because in order to treat patients with on a slit lamp, when you look at them, as you can see, he's a spectacle wearer. And if you've got a mask on, it fogs up your glasses and you can't do your job. So that was their biggest gripe.
Did any of the patients contract COVID following their visit to your facility?
Not to my knowledge. And you know, we followed all the guidelines. We had a little kiosk set up outside the facility, you know, when the traffic light system was high, but you could still practice. And we had thermal scanners like they have in the airports, where they could, through non-contact, could take their pressure, take their temperatures. We had health questionnaires. If they felt they were sick, they had to stay away. Or, as a matter of fact, there was one case where we did say, look, sorry, chap, you've got to go, mate. You've got a cough and a cold or whatever. We can't see you today. So we followed all of those guidelines, no question.
Yeah, we're rat testing before surgical lists.
One of the interesting things, and I do think we just need to start remembering what we've forgotten, is that, you know, natural immunity actually exists. Yeah, so I got COVID early. And, you know, it was 3 days of sniffles and I was, you know, back to the weight room and hitting the bikes, riding up in the hills, and I was just fine. So I didn't feel a strong need to vaccinate. I mean, prior to that, you know, we never enforced people that had survived an infection to get vaccinated against it. You know, that's been a change in our thinking. One that's very good for pharmaceutical companies. So you have to vaccinate the whole population as if natural immunity doesn't exist. I have had COVID. I'm not vaccinated and I am naturally immune, and I haven't had a cough or a cold since then, to be honest.
I also recall a Pfizer representative, a woman named Janine Small, testifying in front of European Parliament that the Pfizer injection was never tested for transmission. Therefore, the Ministry of Health and the New Zealand government must have known about it because they've assured us that they've done their due diligence on the product. So what's the big deal about you not being injected by it? I mean, they're saying that you were putting your patients at risk, but a vaccination wouldn't have stopped you giving them COVID, according to Pfizer's own words.
That's a very, very good question, one that I have thought on deeply for months, if not years, and I don't have a good answer. You better ask the regulatory authorities and the government there, and if you do get an answer, please let me know.
Yeah, I'll put in an official information request. Okay, so now it's over. You've had your day in court. You've got your sentencing. What's the outcome?
It didn't go our way, so I was found guilty, and basically everything the prosecution asked for, they got. So I have been sentenced, and there are these fines to pay. And, you know, I've left medicine, and I'm retraining in IT and enrolled in a BSc in computer science.
And what were the fines?
So the fines were, by the time the fines plus costs, we're looking at $23,000, and also the criminal conviction. So that's the one sticking point, which is what we were hoping to avoid, was to allow Phil to pivot, to continue to work and do the study that he's doing. And because a criminal conviction can make it really difficult to get work if you're wanting to sort of retrain.
Yeah, look, when I gave up medicine just to keep money rolling in, the first thing I looked at was actually being an Uber driver. And the company did a background check, and Waka Kotahi said, nope, you know, he's a danger to the public. We can't employ him. So I went into construction and swapped the scalpel for a sledgehammer and started working there.
And, of course, I finished up at the medical practice, and the opportunity with Reality Check Radio came up. So when I got sort of shoulder tapped by one of the owners and said, look, do you want to do this? As I said to you, Alistair, I thought it was a lot less than what I was going to be doing, but there you go. You know, we're a family like everyone else. You know, we needed to keep, we've got kids to get through school and bills to pay, and you've just got to keep going. You've got to keep moving forward.
It didn't actually occur to me. I realised about the fines, but it didn't occur to me until just now when you said it. There's a criminal conviction here. That's with you for the rest of your life, isn't it?
Well, yeah, different aspects of it. I think within New Zealand, they consider dropping it in some sort of fashion after 7 years. But from a travel perspective, no, it's never dropped. That's what we've been advised. Yeah, no, it does stick with you. And yeah, if you're applying for a job or whatever, that, you know, they'll roll you through the security checks and it'll pop up for sure.
And all of that experience and knowledge in ophthalmology that you had is gone to the New Zealand medical industry now as well.
Yep.
At a time when they tell us that they're drastically short of doctors.
Yeah, it did occur to me. I was working on these construction sites and slinging a siege hammer and banging pegs in. And I thought, you know, is this the very best use that you can put me to? But, you know, we have pivoted and the facility's still being used. We managed to rent it out. So, you know, we've got a lot to be grateful for as well.
And also, do they don't, they never considered the number of people that, and we know so many of them, who took early retirement because of these mandates, or they took extended sabbaticals. They were overseas doctors living in New Zealand who then decided to go back to South Africa, back to the UK, instead of being forced to face what we had to face. And those were the ones that just very, very quietly sort of slipped away. They were never recorded in any data.
No.
So when you have the Ministry of Health gaslighting the New Zealand public that, oh, there are so few of them out there. This is an absolute fringe minority of medical professionals. These are these dreadful anti-vaxxers. They don't take into consideration the much wider, wider group that just quietly slipped out of the system. And most of them haven't come back.
Another one of those invisible effects is the level of distrust in the medical system. You guys were part of it. No doubt you've still got friends in it. Do they realise that there is an issue with trust in the medical profession right now after all of this?
Yeah, well, the ones that we're still in contact with who are sort of freedom orientated, absolutely. Chains of trust have been broken. You know, and what I loved was, you know, when a patient walked into my clinic room or got wheeled into my theatre, it was like the Hippocratic Oath. I got your back. You're number one. So I'm not checking the medical council and what their guidelines. I'm not checking Jacinda Ardern. I'm not checking any of those things or what Big Pharma wants me to do. I'm doing my own research and I'm doing the very best I can for you as an individual. And I must admit, as a patient, if I walk into a doctor's surgery, that's kind of what I want from that medical professional. And that's one of the things that we've lost is that wiggle room where the medical council's gone from being just a regulatory body with those primary functions to saying, you have to say this and you have to do that. And it's suddenly like, well, you know, what if that contravenes what you think is right? You can't serve two masters.
Okay, to finish up, do you regret what has happened?
No, I don't actually. Had it not happened, would I continue as an ophthalmologist? Absolutely. I loved it. It was a great career. But this is in some ways, I see it as a culture war. This is our way of life. This is a very big issue. And, you know, there's those that stand up and those that don't. And I'm very proud to be one of those that has. And in a war, there are casualties. But, you know, there's life after the medicine. I promised my wife, you know, I can be more than just an ophthalmologist and worked very hard to make that happen. It was a very painful transition. I felt like it was my leg amputated, to be honest, but I've worked hard to make it a below-knee amputation and rather than an above-knee one, and found other things to plug my neurons into. And, you know, you've got 30,000 days on the planet. You may as well make them all count.
And we talked about it, you know. We discussed this as a family, and one of the things that we realised is that we desperately did not want to take this shot. So it began and ended with us not doing it and protecting our boys from it as well. But also too, we set an example for our sons that you have to stand when something you believe is so desperately wrong, regardless of potentially the sacrifice. Sometimes you've just got to stand up to it, and you've got to stand up to a bully, and they could blatantly see what was going on.
Mm.
They didn't need influence from us. They could see it. And we didn't want to be parents who capitulated and set that example as if to say, well, we don't agree with this, but we're capitulating because we feel that we have no choice. And there are so many others out there that we know had to make that choice and didn't want to, and we're not belittling the choice that they had to make
absolutely.
At all. We know the sacrifices.
Yep.
Some of our closest friends have had to make that sacrifice. And we thought, well, you know what, we're going to do this, and it's either going to work fabulously well or it's going to end up as we are here.
Yeah.
But, you know, what every door closes, a new one opens.
Yeah, we lost a whole lot of friends, and then we've made a whole lot of friends.
Yeah.
And the friends that we've made, gee, was they're just amazing people. And the experiences, I went down to Parliament grounds. I was one of those filthy, you know, protesters in front of Parliament, and I was very happy to do so. And what an amazing experience it was. What amazing people. The absolute cream of the crop for New Zealand, in my view. And I was so proud to be there. And it was such a fascinating time that it was so grievously mischaracterized by the mainstream media. But no, there's been some great, we've had some great experiences.
Well, thank you for standing up to them. It can't have been easy. But thank you for doing it, and thanks for joining us today on the Inquiry Sessions here on Reality Check Radio. We haven't done an Inquiry Sessions interview for a while, but as I said at the very top of this, I get the feeling that as time goes by, there are going to be more and more stories like yours coming out, and I get the feeling that we're going to be telling these stories for years to come.
Yeah, thanks, Alistair.
Thank you very much.
That's former ophthalmologist Phil McDonald and his wife Marie Buskey, who also happens to be the host of Counterculture right here on Reality Check Radio. And what you've just heard is their story from the COVID era, about a medical council intent on not just punishing Phil for not doing as he was told, but also to destroy him professionally, so he can never practice medicine again. But more importantly, I guess, is the warning his case is to other doctors who might feel the same way as Phil. Behave, do as you're told, or we will ruin you. It's for stories like this that the Inquiry Sessions exists, and I'd even venture to say that it's also the reason why Reality Check Radio exists. Because without Reality Check Radio and the Inquiry Sessions, stories like Phil and Marie's wouldn't get told. The media in our country are just not interested beyond reporting that Phil was found guilty. And they're also not interested in the transformation of the medical council into a political tool. And further, they're not interested in the fundamental ethical decisions that countless doctors were forced into by that transformation. But mostly they just don't seem in any way interested in the repercussions of any of what went on during the COVID era and what it might mean to their futures. At least not yet, but I'm sure one day they will, when the glance of tyranny turns in their direction. Until then, my name is Alastair Harding, and you've been listening to the Inquiry Sessions only on Reality Check Radio. The RCR shop has great gift ideas, from great-looking tees, hoodies, caps, tote bags, bumper stickers, and more. The RCR shop is now open at www.realitycheck.radio/shop.